Yes, thanks for coming. So I will talk about resource theories, and then at the end I will talk about copies, currencies, and catalysis. So this is joint work with Leah Kremer and Renato Renner, who are both at ETH, and most of what I'll talk about today is on the archive, except for the last 10 minutes or so. So what's our main idea? So we started by trying to make resource theories more useful to experimentalists. And the idea here is that while resource theories are a great approach to model what an agent can do or not, the usual approaches are based on assumptions that are unattainable in the lab. So they might be not directly useful to an actual experimentalist. So we thought we started with this very operational goal, and then on the way, we found some very surprisingly foundational things to think about, like where to think about how to model an agent's knowledge and how to model a description of a resource beyond just a quantum state. And we had to think about how to relate different theories that might differ in the language they use to describe the same systems. And also had to try to make sense of what it means to have a subsystem inside a bigger system and how to make sense of locality. Okay, so today I'll start with a short summary of resource theories. I will talk a bit about what are the limitations that we're trying to overcome, and then we'll go over our approach and all these different aspects until we finally build up to the title, which is these tools to quantify resources. Okay, so what are resource theories? This is kind of physics made a game. So what I like about them is that they are very, very operational, like unashamedly. So they don't tell you, oh, let's try to find out how the world works, but they tell you, this is how the world works, these are the physical laws, and you are constrained in your operations that you can apply. For example, you're constrained to local operations and classical communication because you're local agents. And so it's defined by a state space, usually like omega, like for example, all the density matrices, and a set of allowed operations, which is this tau, right? And this allowed operations impose some structure in my state space. Not all states are worth the same because it can go from some states to the others. Okay, so for example, this state here seems to be more valuable than this one down here. And then the job of resource theories is then to try to, you know, characterize this structure that is imposed here, which is a priori on the state space. So there's many examples in quantum information theory. I don't think I need to go over them in this room, but for example, OCC, but also something like thermodynamics, which you'll see a little bit more in a while. So what kind of things do you get from resource theories? Well, you can try to find monotones, so quantities that always decrease or always increase under this preorder. This is the case of free energy in thermodynamics, or say conditional entropies in the case of LOCC. You can try to find what are the free resources, the resources that I can always achieve, even if I don't know the initial state. So in this case, it would be like separable states for LOCC or thermal states for thermodynamics because I can always thermalize the system. So sometimes we want to quantify resources, not only just say, oh, I can go from there to there, but I want to assign a value to each resource. And some ways in which this is normally done is, for example, by having some basic resource that I count the number of copies of. So in the case of LOCC, this is the you could have bell pairs as your basic currency, and then count how many copies of this currency do I need in order to, say, form a quantum state. This is the entanglement of formation. Or in thermodynamics, you can quantify things in terms of work, like how much work do I need to prepare a certain system. And this is, you know, can be mapped to a physical system like a weight that is hanging from some height. Okay. And so this approach is extremely powerful in that, for example, you can derive the laws of thermodynamics just from this, or you can learn about what entanglement really is from here. But okay, so what are the limitations that I want to talk about? So one is that, as we saw, many of the tools used rely on the concept of copies and of independent copies. Okay? And for an experimentalist, copies of a pure state in a tensor product are like spherical curves, which means like an under-modeling of the systems that the people have. And more realistically, an experimentalist will have some description of the system he has. So for example, they might have done some tomography and know that they're in some epsilon ball, but not want to commit to a particular distribution over this. Or they might have like a coarse graining, like a traditional thermodynamic physicist from the 19th century didn't believe that volume and temperature was the ultimate reality. But this, I cannot go further. I cannot probe my system further. This is the only description I can give of my system. Okay. Maybe you don't have a precise characterization of your operations. Maybe you did some process tomography and all you know is that you map some states or some balls to other balls. Okay. Or maybe you don't even describe your systems in terms of the quantum state that you have there, but some preparation procedure to more or less precision. So this is one of the things that we want to do, is try to generalize the current tools in a way that we don't need this kind of a idealistic concept. Okay. So another problem is that it's very hard to relate different resource theories directly. So take, for example, the case of Maxwell's daemon. If you don't know it, there's not much one needs to know. It's just that there is one system, which is a box filled with a gas. And then you can have two different observers. And this observer here, she describes the system via some macroscopic observables, like pressure and volume of the gas. Whereas the daemon describes the same system via, I don't know, either the position and momentum of all the particles or even the quantum state of all the particles, okay? So it's the same system, and they just have different language to describe it. One is more coarse-grained than the other, right? So whereas the daemon has some description of the microstate, like this physicist here has a macroscopic description, which is compatible with many microstates. And so traditionally, there exist resource theories for quantum thermodynamics, there exist resource theories for macroscopic thermodynamics, but no direct way to link the two. Okay. Finally, here's what an experiment looks like. It's an ion trap. It is being shot at with some lead. And here's like a little ion, and it's moving here. Okay. But of course, we don't have like a theory for information processing in this. What we have is a theory for information processing in some abstraction. Okay. So for example, in this case, you can take two internal levels of the ion and say, we take this as our qubit, and then you can take the motional degree of freedom and say, this is a harmonic oscillator, approximated by harmonic oscillator. Okay. And then we work with it. And traditionally in resource theories, you start from here. So you start from having like local resources that you can always compose and you bring together via the tensor product. Whereas in reality, well, we don't even know if you can find such a thing. Or what if you can only find such a representation to some approximation? Right? The question is then, how can we find operational subsystems given a macroscopic, given a global theory? Or what does it mean to even have such local descriptions? So this is something that we'll look at. So what we'll do, and I'll ask you to bear with me for just 1 minute, just say, okay, so we wanted to deal with descriptions of knowledge, for example, epsilon balls. Epsilon balls are just sets of our state space, okay? So for now, why restrict ourselves to balls? Like, let's just consider all the sets of a state space, okay? And think of this as states of knowledge. And then what does it mean to have a set that is contained in another one? It means just that it's a more precise description. So for example, you could have an epsilon ball and an epsilon plus delta ball, which is bigger than the other one. It's a a less precise description of this. So if you're interested, this space in which we'll be working with will be the set of all subsets, and this is ordered by inclusion and forms an order lattice.
Yes.
The original set is your state space, which just means the language that an agent uses to describe the system. So it could be pressure, volume, and temperatures, or it could be density matrices.
Do you mean this could be a space of operationally accessible parameters, or like
yes.
abstract representation used by agents? I mean, like, is it meant to be like more on the operational side or more on the idealistic side?
It could be either. Mm-hmm. It could also be that the state space itself is idealistic and then the sets are the operational mm-hmm. things, but it could also be, because later we'll see how to relate like an operational to an idealistic, for example.
Okay.
So it could be either.
Why is it a subset of the state space? Is it because of probability distribution of the state space?
Okay, this will allow us to do many things, like the relating, like macroscopic descriptions that are compatible with many microscopic states without having to commit to saying, oh, I have this one prior and this is like the one element that will represent my macroscopic description. So for example, in thermodynamics, if you statistical physics, the way you do to, you say, oh, I have some macroscopic description, there are many states that are compatible with this and I'll pick one of them. I'll pick the one that has largest entropy. Right, this is James' principle. But this is, again, just a subjective choice of the observer. And you could want to know, like, what happens if I really don't know, I don't know anything about the probability distribution, I just want to know what would happen to each of these states individually. So.
That seems less general in the sense that.
Okay.
Think of a subset of your state space as an assumption of my ensemble uniform distribution over just those that are in the subset.
Yes, but then you're already mixing it. Yeah.
But for example, you might think of it a collection of AD, you would select some collection of subsets. It can be selected by, in principle, some class of measures, not specific class of measures, it can be, you know,
yes.
supporting some measures and like a description of the measures.
Yes.
It would be actually possible for defining the probability, right? Somehow, this thing is more general.
Yes.
You just need to provide some specific procedure for selection of measures that is defined
right.
by the collection of subsets in order to really gain unique probability. So this is like less structure, more general version.
So, yes. So, for example, so I leave this open now to you to plug in your favorite theory of probability in there and your favorite measure in there. On a subset is your, but I don't want to impose this a priori. Maybe if you see how it goes. Okay. So what gives a collection of subsets this feeling that they are, or this character of being about knowledge, is the way that we demand that functions act on them. So we say that, so here's a function like, I perform some unitary transformation and use my initial state of knowledge, so I don't know which one of these three it is. And I demand, like, obviously that the act of applying this transformation to this set is the same as applying the transformation to each of the elements of the set individually, okay, and then taking the union. Yes? So for example, if I don't know if I have rho or sigma and apply a NOT gate, then the result is either not sigma or not rho. Is it clear? Okay. Good, so then, what is the resource theory then? Well, it's just then our specification space, so all the subsets, together with such a monoid of such functions, which could be, for example, like all of quantum theory or all the LOCC operations or thermal operations, etc., but also something not quantum at all, right? There's nothing quantum about this so far. And then what does it mean? Now we have to find like what structure does a set of operations impose in our state space, in our specification space. Right? Before it was very easy if you're just mapping states to states, but now we're mapping sets to sets, so what does this mean? And it's actually very simple. So imagine that here I have some set V and apply some function F to it and then get here. And then I wanted to know if I am inside the specification, if I could reach the specification W. And the answer in this case is yes, because I just go to a more precise instance of W. So for example, if this was if this is rho and this is like some sigma prime, and I know that I reached some epsilon ball of my sigma that I originally wanted. I'm not sure if this is very clear, but this is what I mean. So for example, if I have some transformation that takes all birds into cats, in particular, it's a special case of transforming all birds into mammals. Okay. So if I wanted to know, does this take me to a mammal? Yes, it does. Not at this stage yet. Not yet. Yes. Yes. So here, yeah, so this is a special case. I say I have a single agent and I have my state space of all density operators in a big Hilbert space, and this is all I ever have. Okay? And then later on, we'll find local descriptions inside this, but not yet. Okay. So this is how, from a set of operations, we reach a pre-order. Okay. And in particular, we can already find what free resources are, and these are just the resources that we can achieve from all of omega. So starting from omega means that we don't know anything in the beginning. We know it could be any of the states. And if from knowing nothing, I can reach to a state, I can reach a set V, then V comes for free. So this is the same as I have a big system and I don't know its state, but I can always let it thermalize and at the end I know I have a Gibbs state there. Or I have a bipartite system, I don't know the state, but I can always throw it away and prepare a separable state with LOCC.
So the generalized work on the system in order to
no.
The state. Yeah.
No. Yes, no, there's no work. So all these operations mean things that come for free. Right? So later on we'll quantify things. Yes?
You can also just define it as, for any set of the original, any subset of the original set, I can get to where I want.
But it's important that it's
meaning, regardless of what my initial state of knowledge was, whether it was narrow or wide or whatever, I can do it.
That's you could also have this. They are different. You see they are different because here it has to be the same function acting on all states. Like really throwing away or letting thermalize. Whereas what you said is if I know that my initial state is A, then I have one way to get to V. If I know the initial state is B, I have a different way to get to V. But you see the difference? So this is, I know nothing, and I have one operation that takes me from knowing nothing to having this. Whereas what you said is slightly different.
Can you give an example of this class of operations that just don't come from just applying functions to the state space? Because, whenever
yes.
You have some
So you could have those, but you could also... You could have functions on the state space that, they always have to act on the state space. That's like this homomorphism property, that they act individually. Yes, but we demand this, right? So we demand that they are defined for each element individually. Otherwise, it's not like... But the thing is that the image of a state need not be a state, could be a set.
So you just generalize the state of... states of knowledge, but mappings between those sets just come from mappings in the whole state space.
Well, they could be mappings from the state space to set, yes.
Yeah.
Or to set, like map a state to a ball, because I don't know exactly what my function does. So imagine you have like some fault-tolerant computation. You know there could be a small error. So you don't know exactly what state you get, but you know that you go to some epsilon ball. You could model it like this. So it's not exactly state to state. Okay. So now let's see how we can relate different theories. So here we have the example of two people that have two different state spaces in which one of them is clearly a coarse graining of the other. Okay, so here's like, let's call it Alice. Alice is state space with all the pressure and volumes. And here's the daemon state space with all the density operators. And of course, that we can always find a mapping that takes every macrostate to the set of all microstates that are compatible with this. So these are all the quantum states that have this pressure and volume. These have to go from Alice to Bob. And we can also go the other way around. So for every quantum state, we can get Alice's description of this quantum state at P and V. So this technically, this is a Galois insertion, which means in particular that if we start from Alice and we go to the daemon and come back to Alice, we end up in the same place. Whereas if we start here from a specific state, and we come to Alice's description, then we come back, then we end up in this like coarse grain kind of lump, which is kind of saying, oh, all the states that are equivalent under Alice's viewpoint.
Can you think more specifically
what
this lump means?
Lump is what I call it. It is an inflating map, such that lump is a lump.
Is it meant to be Galois connection between two positive structures?
Yes.
Okay.
It's good to speak the same language sometimes. Okay.
So actually it's functorial. It's really nice.
Good. What we can also do with this is that, say I have a resource theory here on this view, and I can want to know what is like the emerging resource theory for a macroscopic observer. Okay, so I have a description of how functions act here, and I want to know what does this look for Alice. So the way to do it is, it's the obvious way, so I start with Alice's description, I come over to Bob's side, I apply the function, and then I come back. Right, and I guess a reduced description of the function. So for example, this could be like a very special unitary that here turns out to be something like push a wall a little bit. Okay. And now we've seen how this works for micro and macroscopic observers, but you could also think of this for here being quantum states and here being hidden variables. One can also do it, which is fun, between global and local observers. So imagine here that I have some Hilbert space AB and all the density matrices on AB, whereas here is just Alice, so I have only density matrices in A. So I start with, say, a state rho A, which for Alice is like the ultimate state. And then I want to know what this means from a global perspective. In this case, it's just a set of all, let's see, it's a set of all states that have the same marginal rho A. Yes? That are compatible with Alice's description. And again, I could do the same thing of applying a global function and seeing how this influences the like the local description of Alice. Yes. So in this particular case, like this function to come back to the smaller state space corresponds to the partial trace, as it should be. Yes. And then what we can do as well is now try to restrict ourselves to some subsets of functions here. So for example, only functions on Alice's side, and then we could recover, I don't know, a unitary theory here, or if you have here all the unitaries involving Alice and Bob, then we recover non-unitary maps also here.
It's actually not, it's sort of, I when you can generalize like a very categorical setting, and this will like using an object. So
this is great. Look, this is what we've been trying to do, like seeing how this all fits in with categories.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So we should talk in the next hour. Okay, so now that we saw that we could see local states and local descriptions as just a coarse graining over a global space. Okay, like this. And what we want to know now is how can you find operational subsystems, and what does it mean for two things to be local? So for example, what does it mean to say that they are in a tensor product, that they are independent in a way? So first let's see how we would model the previous situation. Maybe we would model it with some global state, AB, and then having like two of these embeddings. So here would be Alice, who's imagined the first qubit, and Bob is the harmonic oscillator. Okay. And for you could have a description here that has some global correspondent and also Alice's. And then their intersection would be, say, all states that have the same marginal, that have these two marginals.
Okay.
Of which, by the way, the tensor product of the two would be just one element inside here. So then, this is how we'd model them, but now how, what is operational here? What are we looking for? So there's two main notions of independence that we identified. So the first one is that the local descriptions are compatible in the sense that for every state of knowledge here and every state of knowledge here, there's some compatible global set. Okay, so these two things intersect. So this is the case. This is always assumed in the usual resource theories in which you bring like more building blocks together, you bring more, say, bell pairs. But it's not always the case in nature. For example, imagine that this is like some ferromagnetic spin chain, and it has some energy constraints, so the total energy is 10. So although, forget 10, but imagine, you know, the global energy. So it could be that every subsystem individually could have high energy, but they cannot all have high energy at the same time. There are some global constraints. There are some correlations between them. Or my other example is that if this is a deck of cards, of course, every card individually could be the ace of spades, but you can't have two ace of spades at the same time. Okay, so this is not always justified in nature. But it's not too bad. What is more important is to have some notion of independence of transformations. And what I mean by this is that, so I have some function that I think belongs to B, to Bob, and if I apply this function in a global specification, it doesn't do anything to Alice's description. Okay. So for example, you have two qubits and you do some rotation in one qubit, it doesn't change the other qubit. This is the idea. Okay, so these things are what we're looking for. And how can we find them? Because any coarse graining on the global system will give you some lump, which if it satisfies some very easy conditions, then it can always be seen as such an embedding, which gives you the local spaces. But maybe some of these local spaces don't make much sense. So how can we find meaningful local descriptions? You know, it's the same way that you have two qubits and there's many ways to define two subsystems here, right? You could have these two states, or like this, or like this. But depending on your operations, there might be some of these partitions that make more sense than others.
Can you just say, what's your fundamental definition of locality, even conceptual, but also like mathematically, like where the locality starts here, like within your setup?
Yeah, it starts here. It starts in that I have I have a global state space here, and I want to find a way to find local descriptions in descriptions, reduced descriptions that I can relate via these embeddings, these Galois insertions, and I want them to be independent.
But in principle, do you allow any space to be considered global, or you have to necessarily, if you have some predefined notion how the global is constructed, that there could be a right contention from the first
No, no, no. This is not the idea at all. It's
so you allow any space to be considered
as yes.
potentially global one.
Yes.
And then you always, but you have like a consistency check whether it would be actually meaningfully
okay.
global.
So one thing would be like I give you some state space which I tell you, oh, it's global, and then you come back and say, oh, I have a way to grouping things together to say that these things are equivalent. That results in these state spaces, and I call them local. And then I check, oh, but do they satisfy these conditions? Like,
so
are local things independent or not? Or do they depend on each other's transformations
so
or not?
So like actually defining, two defining properties that candidates for local spaces
yes.
with respect to
yes.
the given one have to satisfy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Although you might not always be able to guarantee them and then be happy with some approximation. Okay. And then what I'll see later is now one recipe to actually find them. Okay. And that this works in theories that are very rich in the operations you have, and it's based on commutativity of operations. So the idea is that if what I do on Alice's side and what I do on Bob's side, it doesn't matter the order, then they might be defining local subsystems, independent local subsystems. And so here's how you do it. First, you have to find, you take only the set of transformations. And this is something operational, this is something you know. And you can test them, see how they act. And then you're going to find the commutation relations between them. So for example, I don't know if you can see, but here, imagine that you have three qubits, and you start from subset A, which is almost all operations on the first qubit, but not all of them. Okay. And then you take the commutant of this, which is all the operations that commute with all of this, which gives you operations on second and third qubit. And then you take the commutant again, okay? And now we recover everything on the first qubit. So this taking the bicommutant is related to some von Neumann closure of operator algebra. So it's the same spirit. So this is, and then I take the set of all such things, all these bicommutants on operations, and I say, okay, each one of them defines me a subsystem for now at a level of transformations, not yet at a level of descriptions. So we're just trying to find what operations commute with what. Okay. And this thing has some structure. So imagine that you started, for example, with all the operations on one qubit and all operations on the second qubit, and you want to find all the joint operations. So obviously this is not just a union because then you're missing all the operations that correlate the two. But then if you take the commutant, and you take the commutant again, you get kind of this closure, and you get all the operations. So the set of all of these subsystems of operations, together with this and with intersection, is again a lattice, if you're into this order theory stuff. But for now, we only have sets of operations, right? And we want to relate this to transformations. So what we do is we find, for each subsystem of transformations, we kind of find a lump based on them. So the idea being find all the sets that kind of converge under these transformations. So I will not go into much.
Definition of a specific closure operator.
I'm not sure anyone else here is more clarified. but it's good that this means something.
Can you just repeat what is, you said, you know, you want to find a meaningful local description. So it's the final thing, the coming out of the coming out that constitutes your local system?
No, no. So this is still a transform, it's like a set of transformations. Okay. You know, I take this set of transformations and I see how sets of states act under them, or how they look under them. So I can lump them together according to whether they are changed by such a thing or not. In the sense, yes, yes. It's a bit more, there's more steps to it, but this is the main idea. So,
so you categorize them into those that are non-invariant and those that are invariant.
Yes.
That's how you break it up into
a... And this will be how I break them up. Yes. And from here, I can actually find all the local descriptions.
Sort of, yeah.
Yes.
In this particular example, when you start from this single utilitaries, you take commutants, then you take double commutants, and come back to the old single utilitaries source.
Yes.
Like algebra and single. But about, does it happen more generally in this general class of transformation?
Yes.
Because it's not always for me that if you take the commutants, it's double commutants. Are you like always certain that you end up with this?
Yes, yes. So, yeah, yeah. Wherever, even this is already a subsystem. Yes. And whatever monoid you start with,
right.
Whatever monoid you start with, in this case, a monoid of operations, which just means you can compose them and there's an identity. So whatever monoid you start with, if you apply this procedure of finding the bicommutant, you always end up with this very nice structure, which is a lattice. That means that you can always bring two together and find like the joint thing. That's this one.
Yeah, so
and
so
you can also intersect. Yes. 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 Even when you take, yeah, okay.
I mean,
I was going to say when you take by commutant of the commutant, you also end up in the commutant. Yes. Okay. So if you do this, then the resulting local theories are independent. And in particular, in the case of, if your operations are all the maps, then you recover the partial trace. So this does not mean that these are like the operational subsystems that you have. They might be maybe a bit too generous. I had some example, I don't remember it now, but it's a beginning to try to find operational subsystem. Which I imagine people must do something similar to this in field theories. Do they?
this is something that I think.
Okay, so the whole idea here was to try to find these local descriptions. Okay, first we characterize them, what they should satisfy, and then we have like one way to find them. But in general, you can just test any candidate that you give me. Okay, so now we're down to the tools we needed. So let's just review some of the tools that I use normally in traditional resource theories. So many of them have to do with, say, the cost of the resource. So say the minimum number of copies of some, you know, belt pairs of some standard resource that you need to produce it. Or the yield of a resource, which is like how much of this basic resource can you obtain from your role. Or say the rate of conversion between two resources, the asymptotic conversion rate between two resources. Okay. Although in theories like thermodynamics, you could have something very different, like the weight of the height of a weight. Okay. So we have this problem here. So let's just have a small look at one way of how we could generalize these ideas. So one is that you can have composition without having a tensor product. As we saw before, we can just take the intersection of two local descriptions and say this is the composition. So for example, if I had, you know, I have a cold bath and a hot bath and I bring them together, but I cannot ensure that there are no correlations between them. Maybe they were in contact at some point before and there's some small correlations, but I might still want to know what I can do with this. So all I know is the local descriptions. Or I can have local descriptions and some specification that tells me, oh, there's very small correlations between them. So the other thing is that I can talk about copies of local resources without having this building block approach, without starting with identical Hilbert spaces and tensoring them up. I can ask, well, in this global theory, do there exist like these identical Hilbert spaces? And what do I mean by this? How can I quantify this being identical? So this is based in isomorphisms that you can find between the two local theories. Okay, so if they're isomorphic and if they behave in a certain way within the global structure, then you can say that they are identical. And then you can start, you can recover concepts like this, but for notions of, without having to assume the tensor product. And here, for example, instead of having a pure state, you could have some epsilon ball and still think of how to compose them. Okay. But not all resources are like copies. You could have something like the height of a weight. And in general, what one needs to quantify resources is to have some reference. So the idea is that, oh, I have a set of resources which I'm so lucky that they are ordered. So for example, this could be the height of my weight, like it's on top and it's like lowering, 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 and then can always go from here to here. Or this could be, you know, having the specification that tells me I have 10 copies of a Bell state, and here I have 9 copies, and here I have 8 copies, etc. And if they are ordered, then I can assign a value to each of them, just a real number that satisfies this order. Yeah. And now the question is, how do I use this to quantify the value of resources? And it's very similar to the other case. So this drawing was the last one I made. But it will all make sense. So let's think, I have some target system, which is inside my big local theory, and my big global theory, and I want to go from Vt to omega t, okay? So for example, from rho to sigma. And I want to ask, well, how much money do I need to spend in order to go from V to W? So the way to do it is, okay, I see, what does V look like in the big space? And then can I go from knowing that I have V and knowing that I have 10 coins to knowing that I have W, that's this blue one here, and knowing that I have 5 coins? Yeah. And then I come back. Okay, then I did W. And then I went from having this many coins to this many coins. And this difference will be the balance. So it's having some transformations that I can go from having the currency C and being on the global version of this thing to having this currency C prime and being in the global version of this thing. And then I can think, so if I have the balance between going from one state to the other, then I can think of just having the cost of creating such a resource. Well, this would be just the balance of going from knowing nothing on my initial target system to knowing Vt. Yeah. And the yield will be the balance from knowing Vt to knowing nothing. So how much coin can I get in going from this very specific thing to something much bigger? Okay. If this seems a bit confusing, just believe that you recover the usual notions of copies in the usual case when everything is well behaved.
Is it this particular like description, is it like motivated by some decision theoretic structure? Because it seems that, like it's putting the one level more of like you said, coins.
Yeah, so the basics was everything that came before coins, and now I care about quantifying resources. And for now, I'm just trying to generalize the usual tools that are used in resource theories, which is like, how many copies do I need to reach a state? And I can do it in this way. But I will comment in a bit.
Because it's just in a way, you could call it just a risk minimization, something like this. If you I'm not sure whether it can be.
Okay, I don't have risk here yet. No. Can I just say it's not that for the time being? And then in the end, maybe you can. So, yeah.
First question. In your supreme mode, did you mean to say value c minus value c prime? Rather than value c prime minus value c? It seems to me you're talking about a situation where you have sort of a yield coins.
So I guess, well, let me see. I just changed all the signs before the talk, so it's possible that it's the other way around. So in this, I guess I want it to be positive when I gain something. So it's C prime minus C. So I want this to be positive.
C prime, your example, I assume that the higher points in the partial order were, you said 10 points for
yes.
C, 5 points for C prime.
Yes. So in this case, C prime is worth less, so this will be negative.
And that's what you want. You want it to be
negative. Yes, and I want there to be a minus sign here.
Okay, so you want that to be negative, which means the supreme means the.
You're wrong. Then it should be an inf. Yes.
Okay.
Then it should be an inf. Yes.
Okay, so
or the other way around.
Okay, so now here's my question. So that's what I thought. My question is, if you're working at the level of the coarse grain theory, then you don't have access to the micro stuff. Then
oh, I do. So, okay. So the idea is that, you know, this all could be also the image of some embedding of some other system that I call my wallet. It's like, you know, Alice and Bob, they have some states,
yeah.
But then they have a wallet of entangled states,
right,
which are not in the same system. And I do require some independence between the two.
Should I think of balance as the most I can hope to get? As
yes.
A
yes.
But, you know, given my partial description, I don't know that I can get that. It's just the most I can hope to get. But I could also get less because that V state is consistent with.
Yeah.
Same thing?
Yes.
This is not in any sense the sort of the deterministic balance that you would get under doing this, but something more like an upper bound of the balance.
Yes.
So
yes.
Right
yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Lower
yes. Yes.
Bound of the
yes.
Balance would be an infimum rather than a supremum.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah. You're always allowed to be less clever. Yes, and lose money. But okay, so
I think to do a suboptimal operation, but my concern is rather that somebody who only knows B and doesn't know where you are in the micro state just has no guarantee that
okay,
the wallet state of B corresponds to C as opposed to anywhere else in that order.
Okay, so yes, exactly. Let's get to this. Shall I get?
You're getting to this, okay.
Yes, I'm getting to this. Yeah. Yes. So just before I get to this, so I just wanted to say that you have also have versions for if you want approximate transformations, like if you have some notion of distance or some other metric or any criteria to distinguish states, and then you can talk about is the theory robust under this distance. So for example, linear maps preserve the trace distance. Don't increase the trace distance. Okay. And then you can also have the notion of like approximate cause or approximate field. And now all these things are meaningful under some conditions. So let's look at them. So it's exactly kind of what you said. Imagine that you have a currency that is kind of translationally invariant. So it doesn't mean if the value here is the same as the value there, it doesn't matter where you start. And you can always do this, okay? So in this case, the balance becomes like a strong notion. And in fact, it can lead us to conditions, like necessary and sufficient conditions for resource transformations in the usual way. So if the yield of the initial state is bigger than the cost of the final state, then you can always perform this transformation because you could just sell this state and buy the other one. And the other way around, so if you can do this transformation, then it better be that the cost of this state is bigger than the yield of this, otherwise you could just get a perpetual motion machine. And examples that we guess are applied like this, copies of Bell's pairs or thermodynamic work. So it behaves linearly. But there could be currencies with very different regimes in which above a certain threshold, things become easier. So for example, think of money, that if you don't have any money, you cannot invest in order to gain something. But if you have a lot of money, then you can invest a small amount and then make even more money, say, for example. Or, and catalysts are one example of this. So it's like above a certain threshold, if you have some, there's some state that if you have it, then you can always, you can perform operations without degrading it. And in the extreme case, you have like this, what I call the Midas theory, which are theories in which this does not hold, so you can always, there's some resource that allows you to create more of itself. Midas, because everything you touch becomes gold. And these are actually the most interesting cases, which we haven't studied yet. Yes, there are cases in which you have some ordered set of resources that you want to use as a reference, but they don't behave very well. Or they have some strange regimes in which if you have less of them, they're worth less. And if you have more, they become suddenly much, much better. So this is something we'd like to study and try to find theories for which this is true. To go back to your comment, I think in this case, we're looking from the perspective of a global observer who wants to perform a transformation in one subsystem T and who may or not know. So in this case, he may know the initial currency. And if it's translationally invariant, then this observer is good, right? He doesn't even need to know how much money I have. I just know that I need to take, say, 20 of it. If it's not translationally invariant, then it makes a big difference whether you know what your initial currency is or not. But we are thinking of from the perspective of a global observer now, or at least someone who knows in which of these cases you are.
Let me rephrase that question. If the transformation on the right-hand side of omega that's required to get to the maximum yield is a transformation on microstates, how can an observer who only has access to the macro description implement that transformation?
Aha. Uh-huh.
Suppose that there are many micro transformations, but some of them give different yields. They don't
yes.
give this maximum yield. And perhaps all those micro transformations look the same from the macro description. So if the macro observer just did the macro transformation, they might have a distribution of different yields rather than the maximum yield.
Yes, okay. This would be a different case. So this is like, okay, this observer knows that the currency like this, and the transformation he does is on this global space. So inside this view, okay, and then comes here just to get the local description here. But if you want a macroscopic observer, then it should be you'd have to make an embedding of this whole thing, which would result in embeddings of the currencies and embeddings of the functions. And then in that case, then maybe he or she can do less. But it has not to do with this particular embedding.
Okay, so I think I understand the answer to one of my questions. Maybe a good example would be the epsilon null. So we imagine the observer has access to unitaries, but just doesn't know what the state is to within some null. So this mm-hmm. Are you saying, though, that in addition to that local description, the observer also knows what the sort of value of the wall it is initially? Is there like a second macro description? Like, the observer knows that they start at C 10 coins as opposed to starting other number of coins that's consistent with your first black circle?
Yes, yes. So,
you're
yes.
Assuming that they know?
Yes, they know, yes. In this case, they know this, yes.
Okay. So then it would just be like the intersection, like that whole region that's in green.
Yeah.
That's what the.
This is what they start with, yeah. Yeah, this is what they know, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you can say it's like a sort of redefinition of what observer is actually how it's represented in the brain.
Yes, I define like this kind of wallet, which is not here represented, but it could be like here, like where all the currencies live, and this would be like the global description of all the currencies. And I have access to this and to this, so I can see their intersection.
But then why are you taking the supremum over C? C is part of the specification of the initial state.
Because... Yeah, I don't need the supremum over C. Yes, you're right.
So you just take the supremum over C prime?
Yes, I could do this with the supremum over C prime, yes. Yeah.
Could, or you would have to. I mean, it seems to me that C is part of the specification of the initial state. It would be more like the balance of going from B T intersect C, something like that. That's where you're starting. To W T would be the expression you gave the supremum over C prime, something like that.
Yes, but then... Yes, for this, yes. But, you know, this is like this special observer who knows the money that he has in this wallet. Right. But if I want to know, you know, I might also want to know how much money would I need to do this transformation.
Right.
So I can optimize over all initial states of the wallet. That's why.
Yeah, it's sort of the minimum amount of money I need, if it so happens that it costs the maximum amount. Like, you really don't know which... starting wallet state you're in, you don't know how much it's going to cost.
Yes, no, yeah, I'm allowing to all say, I start here, no, it doesn't work, then I start here, it doesn't work, oh, I start here, actually it works. So,
it's a bit the purpose is different. I mean, like, the procedure is like, what to do about defining what is the optimal choice for what, how you find your server.
Well, how much?
Like, postpone this discussion until I
okay. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. So, yes, I was actually finishing.
Oh.
That's why I went back to the discussion. Should I really? I'll really, really finish. Okay. So, just to go quickly over what we've done. So. By modeling this knowledge, we could like not only write descriptions of resources, but also see how operations act on them. We could relate different theories and try to get a better understanding of what it means to have a local description, and also how to find some operational subsystems within a global theory. And also, maybe I didn't discuss this so much, but local descriptions and local operations are not necessarily related. And like this recipe that I gave is like a recipe that kind of ties them together. Okay, we can compose resources without having to assume that they're in a product state. And if I look at some ways to quantify the value of resources. Okay. Up. So just this, can I? So there's just some applications that I would like to talk about. One that we're working on now is like trying to relate micro and macro thermodynamics and try to get operational notions of temperature, for example. Something that I'd like to work on maybe after July, the summer school, would be try to see how to apply these ideas to field theories, because you have a global theory and you have to try to find local descriptions. Of course, it could be applied to other fields. And so two of the things that I'm the most interested in exploring now is we saw how to get local views of local observers, right? How to find their local descriptions, how they define a state space. But we didn't relate them to the actual eye of the observer. So if you have a physical theory, not a resource theory, then your observer is just something, it's like a subsystem acting inside a big theory itself. And you want to know, well, how does the subsystem that defines my agent relates to the view of this agent. If this question is well understood. Not sure if it's... So here's like something very subjective, which is a point of view. And you found how to find points of views. But now I want to try to think of what physical systems could result in this point of view. Okay. And then finally, to try to use this kind of approach and this kind of... local structures to think beyond resource theories about physical theories in general. Okay. And as you know, there's been some recent work on generalized resource theories in this room, even, and we're now trying to work a little bit on how to relate our approach to theirs, even though theirs is a bottom-up approach. But people say you can use categories for everything, so we'll try. And of course, there's a lot of work in theories of knowledge, and much of this is very similar to what we have. So thank you. And I forgot what the discussion was.
Let me ask you a brief question. One of the places where approximate transformation is relevant is in discussions of embezzlement and whether what you talk about in terms of, for example, like how close your campus festival term is interesting.
Yes.
I would characterize the situation thermodynamics as still unclear how to get a really nice definition of approximate transformation.
Yes.
Since this, we tried applying this to solve this problem. Define a notion of approximate transformation and this clearly rules out embezzlement.
Yes. Yes.
They have like three different proposals.
Yes.
Here is a very fundamental thing that which of these proposals is clearly the right one.
This is something we are developing in the new paper, and I'm not sure if we have it done already. One thing that seems clear is that you should not allow for any trace distance on the catalyst. Allowing the catalyst to be returned in an epsilon closed state. I don't think you should allow this, no. I don't think you should.
Return to the exact state.
Yes.
So
or a subset.
Outside the realm of experimental possibility.
Well, not if you start with set. It still seems a bit, yes. But Renato has this analogy in which you could think of oil as a catalyst because my model, my knowledge about oil, and then I use one barrel. But I still assign approximately the same state to like the total amount of oil. So if I were to represent this by a quantum state, then the trace distance would be very, very small. But clearly,
I would call that the embezzlement problem.
Yes.
A little bit.
Yes. But clearly, like I've. So it's clear then that the trace distance, if you want to allow for some epsilon, it cannot be the trace distance. But maybe catalysis is hopelessly unexperimental. I don't know.
Actually. Yes.
I can check what we have already. Yeah. Yep. Great. Yes.
So I had a question that was related to this early question about representing knowledge as sets rather than probability distributions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you apply this to the link between macroscopic thermodynamics and the microscopic dynamics.
Yes.
Aren't you going to hit this problem of like there always being a microstate compatible with the macrostate that just violates all of the macroscopic?
Yeah, but
so that for every macro state, there is a micro state that would violate all of the macroscopic.
Yes, but.
Oh, well, but,
I don't work. Yes, but I need to work. If I want to talk about this, then I need to work with the whole set of them, not with one particular element. Like, that's the problem that, you know, statistical physics avoids, because the state, the precise state that they choose is very well behaved, like this Gibbs distribution. But here we don't have this problem at all, because we want whatever transformation to apply to all the elements here. So even if one of them is really good and it'll give me something really weird, the set that I end up with also includes the image of all the others that are better behaved. So if I go back to this.
All of these weird microstates are just going to go to
weird microstates.
Things that have wildly different macrostates.
Yeah, so then.
So
it,
your prediction is just going to be the same number of
macrostates. Or I get some epsilon ball, or I get something. I don't know. Yes, this is what we're working on now. So let's try to see how far we can take this. This approach, or if we need to introduce some other notion of typicality, of what it means to be a typical state inside the set. And I would guess it would not be too strange, because we found so far kind of laws of thermodynamics in this case. So I would expect it not to be too odd, but it could happen, yes. Yes. But so one of the things that we're trying to work on is trying to also find, if we didn't have a measure of probability, can we still find any notion of typicality? And maybe try to use some definitive kind of arguments to find this. Yes.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Well, it's totally obvious question, but it's related to the distinction between sets and probability distributions. So let me see if I can fill that gap. So the thing is, if I have the thermodynamic context, remove some barrier and expect the volume to increase a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So the macro state, I might have thought that something of a certain volume would evolve to something of a bigger volume. But one of the micro states actually is chosen so that all the particles go to a corner and the volume actually decreases.
Yep.
So on the right hand side, all the micro states consist of the initial volume get mapped to a set which includes a larger interval of volumes over on the left hand side. So, you know, rather than having sort of something focused around volume V that evolves to something focused around V prime or V prime bigger than V, it's just it now is, you know, the final state could be lots of different volumes. It could be smaller volumes, it could be bigger volumes.
It could be like the set of all these things. Yes, that's exactly what you asked.
So the relevance of probability theory would be something that you consider just having a set of possibilities. You had a measure and you said, okay, well, the cases where the volume decreases are very low measure, and therefore at the end of the day I have a distribution on the left hand side, where most of the weight of that distribution is at higher volumes.
Yes, then I approximate this, yes.
So that seems like an advantage to the use of distributions as opposed to just the use of sets.
But you can use sets and then plug in your distribution on top of the sets. And what we will try to see is how important it is to do this.
I think the point that you add probability in order to add more knowledge, like statement of your I don't want to go look into those like propensity, but like your attitude, you know, your individual preference to some specific organization of the knowledge around this thing. But at the end, like, this would matter to you in support of the measure, which serves something that's completely important. So as long as it's not speak of criticality to the issues, I think it's just
Or for example, imagine that this gas was given to you by an adversary, and all you can see is that it is has this pressure and volume, but it could be that the adversary chose precisely one of these strange states, right? And you want to see if you want to be really, really sure about the end. Oh, okay, so then you'd have to say, okay, then thermodynamics is a non-conspiracy theory, and now we have to see what kind of assumptions we need to.
Go on with this, like that is an order theory. You have some extent you have probabilities. Because it's very nice because you have bare sets.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I guess it's not that easy to compare stuff if you measure.
Yes, I don't know. This is the next step. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Other questions?
All right.
Thank you.